every department. And as a result, companies that stick with them become more coherent. Adaptable organizations tend to be more openly connected ones. Intuit's culture of transparency was ingrained by co-founder Scott Cook and strengthened by coach Bill Campbell, who served as Intuit's CEO and longtime chairman. "Bill was one of the most open guys I ever met," says Atticus Tyson, Intuit's senior vice president and chief information officer. "He could read people, and he invested in them. You always knew what he was thinking and that he was in your corner." The coach's legacy lives on. A few years ago, to help the IT department adapt as Intuit moved to the cloud, Atticus introduced OKRs to his direct reports. The following quarter, he rolled the system down to the director level, the quarter after that to all 600 IT employees. He was determined not to force the new process. "We didn't want bureaucratic compliance," Atticus says. "We wanted enthusiastic compliance. I wanted to see if the OKR system would succeed on its own, and it really did." So each quarter, Intuit's IT group tackles about 2,500 active objectives as they built their goal-setting muscle with real-time automated data and routine check-ins. Users align roughly half of their OKRs with the goals of higher-ups or their department. Collectively, they view their manager's OKRs more than 4,000 times per quarter, or 7 views per employee, a strong marker of engagement. After the LASIK surgery of OKRs, contributors see clearer links between their own day-to-day work, their colleagues' priorities, their team's quarterly objectives, and the company's True North mission. Intuit's story demonstrates the benefits of an OKR pilot project before or even without a full company rollout. A few hundred users may suffice for an OKR laboratory to iron out any kinks before deployment at scale. At Intuit, says CEO Brad Smith, who posts his own goals in his office for anyone to see, connected goal setting is critical to enabling employees to do the best work of their lives. Here's Atticus Tyson.
"I'd been working at Intuit for 11 years on the product side before moving to the IT department. Then, in 2013, I became CIO. I made the switch because I loved the company, and I knew IT needed to evolve to help Intuit on its cloud-bound mission. It was a stressful, exciting time. The organization was pivoting in several directions at once, from desktop software to cloud-based software, from a closed platform to one open to thousands of third-party apps, from a North American company to a global company. As we leaned into a long-term strategy to become an integrated ecosystem, we were changing from a house of brands, TurboTax, Quicken, QuickBooks, to the branded house of Intuit. In the storm of disruption, IT often bears the brunt of in-house frustrations, partly because the operation tends to be opaque. Any 30-plus-year-old company will accumulate layers of technology with significant complexity, especially a technology company. In IT, we're always juggling the needs of internal partners with the demands of end users. We bridge the gap between technology and business outcomes. Perhaps toughest of all, we have to balance people's expectation for systems perfection with our imperative to improve and invest in the future. For example, Intuit had 9 different billing systems to serve its array of products, each with its own challenges. We were putting out fires every day when we really wanted to build a more unified next-generation billing technology. How could we signal to Intuit's workforce what mattered most and keep them all connected? 3 years ago, taking a page from General Stanley McChrystal, Brad introduced alignment triangles. Now we had a tool on paper and in practice to drive clarity and connectedness by delineating our common objectives. Brad began with a triangle for the company as a whole and encouraged department heads to follow suit. "I'd just become CIO and asked for a stay. I didn't think IT was quite ready to be so disciplined in such a public way." Intuit has a long cultural history around learning and experimentation. We try a lot of things, retain the elements that work best, and adapt them to make them our own. In keeping with our culture, I partnered with HR to try OKRs in Enterprise Business Solutions, or EBS, which is our formal name for IT, to see what we could learn. I'd first come across objectives and key results in 2014 when Googling for goal setting. After some research, it seemed that OKRs might help us shift the way we operate and how we perceive ourselves. Modern IT goes way beyond checking off boxes for processing help tickets or change requests. It's about adding value to the business, shedding redundant clone systems, creating new functionality, finding future-oriented solutions. IT leaders need to give people air cover to back burner some of the day-to-day and focus on more valuable, longer-term initiatives. Our EBS needed some basic changes to become the modern team Intuit needed. Today, all 600 employees in my department own 3 to 5 business objectives per quarter, as well as 1 or 2 personal ones. The system is powerful because it's so simple, and most of all, because it's so transparent and connected. I was convinced that for our OKRs to be effective, they had to be visible through all of Intuit, even if no one outside EBS used them. I wanted everyone to know exactly what we were doing and how and why. When people understand your priorities and constraints, they're more likely to trust you when something goes sideways. Early on, I found it challenging to separate my individual objectives from the department's. As IT's leader, I thought they should coincide, but it wasn't a good optic. Our top-level objectives mostly endured from quarter to quarter, typically for 18 months. Teams and individuals adjusted their own OKRs as the environment changed and we kept making progress. And they were asking, quite reasonably, what is the CIO doing if his OKRs never change? I got the message. Now I have my own objectives, and I ladder up to top-level OKRs like everyone else. We made it a point to implement the system department-wide in every office, beyond our Bay Area headquarters and San Diego, California. EBS has teams in 3 other U.S. regions and in Bangalore, the high-tech center of southern India. In addition, we have support teams in every Intuit location around the globe. When people are dispersed from the center, they wonder what headquarters does, and vice versa. OKRs got rid of that mystery. They made our geographically dispersed department more cohesive and connected. One top-level EBS objective is to rationalize, modernize, and secure all technology used to run Intuit. Lately, whenever I travel to see a team in Plano, Texas, or Tucson, Arizona, I hear people saying things like, "This project is rationalizing our portfolio," or "How can we modernize that system?" No matter where they happen to be stationed, our employees use those same 3 verbs. When a new project comes up for discussion, they'll ask each other how it fits into our OKR template. And if it doesn't, they'll rightly flag it, "Why are we doing this?" Live data from the cloud. Intuit views itself as a 34-year-old startup. Beginning with the birth of the personal computer in the 1980s, our history represents a series of disruptions, with each new platform upending its predecessor. Our first product was on DOS. Then we moved to Windows and Macintosh on the desktop, then to mobile devices, and now to the cloud. A great benefit of OKRs in the cloud era is their inherent transparency, which promotes horizontal alignment between departments. With public OKRs, the data and analytics team could see from the start what our financial systems team had embarked upon. It was obvious that they should work together to build reporting functionality in support of the new feature in parallel. As a result, the teams connected their objectives in real time rather than after the fact. That marked a fundamental change from our historical way of doing things. At a desktop software company, leaders look at operations through a 20th century retail lens. They analyze sales reports and channel flow. While they'll do their best to predict where the business is going, their line of sight is mostly limited to the rearview mirror. By contrast, a cloud-based business wants to know what is happening now. How many subscriptions came in this week? How many trials are ongoing? What's our conversion rate? A customer can Google an online product, skim through the relevant marketing page, conduct a quick trial, and make a purchase, all in 10 minutes. For leaders to keep pace with the market, they need to view their funnel on a daily basis. That's why an IT team needs to be thinking about real-time reporting, data, and analytics, even as it builds features like wholesale billing. We've captured this necessity in a top-level objective: enable every Intuit worker to make decisions based on live data. This has four key results. The first, deliver functional data marts for HR and sales. The second, complete migration to new enterprise data warehouse built for real-time access. The third, create a single team operating all data visualization tools across Intuit to drive a unified strategy. And fourth, create a teaching module to help people in other teams use data visualization tools. A tool for global collaboration. As Intuit becomes more global, asynchronous collaboration is increasingly vital. When we're working from headquarters with our team in Bangalore, live video is of limited utility. With a 13-hour time difference, our associates in India will be sleeping when we're working, or vice versa. 3 years ago, we had few real options. Intuit generously invested in the latest workplace tools, but we lacked solutions for persistent chat, collaborative authoring, and video conferencing. People had to improvise. Productivity suffered. To address the problem in a more visible and connected way, we moved workforce technology from being a key result up to a separate top-level OKR. With our new strategic emphasis, we added a number of modern tools within 6 months. Our OKR platform enabled teams across EBS to align with this top-level objective. We installed Slack for persistent chat, Google Docs for collaborative editing, Box for content management, and BlueJeans for modernized video technology. All of these platforms were integrated with a single authentication system. Now people can focus on their work instead of wasting time to figure out which tool to use. There's an art to goal setting, and more than a few judgment calls. If you choose to elevate a key result for a time, it helps to be transparent about it. Leaders need to explain, yes, I want us to focus on that one right now as a top-level objective. Once we get good at it, and it no longer needs the extra attention, we'll let it drift back down into a KR. From a leadership standpoint, you're always adjusting the altitude. Studies have been telling us forever that frontline employees are happier when they can see how their work aligns to the company's overall goals. I've found this especially true at our remote sites. I've heard it directly from people in Bangalore. My objective is directly a key result of my manager's OKR, which ties directly to the top-level EBS objective, which ties to the company shift to the cloud. I now understand how what I'm doing in India connects to the company mission. That's a powerful realization. By making our goals transparent, OKRs have unified our far-flung department. Thanks to structured, visible goal setting, our connection knows no boundaries. Horizontal connections. Intuit was a flat organization from the beginning, with only a handful of levels between the CEO and frontline employees. Our founder, Scott Cook, believed the best idea should win, not the biggest title, and that still holds true today. When I entered the company as a group manager, I was impressed by the collaborative culture and openness to new ideas. Even when we ran things within silos, we were vertically open. You could always speak freely to your manager or your manager's manager and get a respectful hearing. OKRs have opened our department horizontally across different teams. At first, it was an awkward transition. Everybody in IT instinctively wanted to link up and align primarily with their manager's OKRs or with mine. The first quarter we used OKRs, I went into the platform, and one day I found literally hundreds of key results under one of my top-level objectives. I told people, you don't need to worry about connecting to me or to your manager. Your manager is still your manager. You'll continue to collaborate. None of that's going to change. But you need to disconnect from us and connect to each other. Our e-commerce and billing teams work under separate vice presidents who roll up to me. If e-commerce is building a shopping cart, billing needs to bring related features to market. In the old way, the two engineering teams would run independently and report progress to their respective program managers, who would try, with uneven success, to connect from above. the people doing the actual work had no direct contact. But with horizontally visible OKRs, engineers on different teams are now intentionally connected as they link to each other's objectives. Both teams are grounded by our enduring top-level goals and empowered by real-time data. Quarter by quarter, they can iterate against the department's objectives while figuring out how to best coordinate. We're moving toward autonomy and away from senior committee mandates. Hierarchies can't go fast enough. It takes too long to move up and down a chain of command. Our leaders still set the context, ask the important questions, and provide data as needed. But it's our interconnected groups, the people on the ground, who are gaining insights and making decisions to propel us all forward, together. Atticus Tyson, Senior Vice President and Chief Information Officer for Intuit.
Chapter 10 is superpower number 3, Track for Accountability. W. Edwards Deming wrote, "In God we trust. All others must bring data." The benefits of OKR connectedness and transparency, as shown by Intuit, are amplified by our next superpower. One underrated virtue of OKRs is that they can be tracked and then revised or adapted as circumstances dictate. Unlike the traditional frozen set-them-and-forget-them business goals, OKRs are living, breathing organisms. Their life cycle unfolds in three phases, which I'll consider in turn. The setup. While general-purpose software can get an OKR process up and running, there's a catch. It doesn't scale. When one Fortune 500 company recently tried to ramp up its goal-setting cadence, it hit a wall. All of its 82,000 contributors had dutifully recorded their annual objectives in Microsoft Word files. A move to quarterly OKRs would have generated 328,000 files per year. They'd all be public in theory, but who would have the patience to search out the connections or alignment? And if you share a goal that nobody sees, is the system truly transparent? In 2014, when Bill Pence came to AOL as Global Chief Technology Officer, the top-line company and division goals were presented on a spreadsheet and rolled down from there. But they never really had a home where they connected on a daily basis with people, says Pence. Without frequent status updates, goals slide into irrelevance. The gap between plan and reality widens by the day. At quarter's end, or even worse, at year's end, we're left with zombie OKRs. On paper, what's and how's that are devoid of life or meaning. Contributors are most engaged when they can actually see how their work contributes to the company's success. Quarter to quarter, day to day, they look for tangible measures of their achievement. Extrinsic rewards, the year-end bonus check, merely validate what they already know. OKRs speak to something more powerful, the intrinsic value of the work itself. As the bar for structured goal setting rises, more organizations are adopting robust, dedicated, cloud-based OKR management software. The best-in-class platforms feature mobile apps, automatic updating, analytics, reporting tools, real-time alerts, and integration with Salesforce, Jira, and Zendesk. With three or four clicks, users can navigate a digital dashboard to create, track, edit, and score their OKRs. These platforms deliver transformative OKR values. They make everyone's goals more visible. Users gain seamless access to OKRs for their boss, their direct reports, and the organization at large. They drive engagement. When you know you're working on the right things, it's easier to be motivated. They promote internal networking. A transparent platform steers individuals to colleagues with shared professional interests. And they save time, money, and frustration. In conventional goal setting, hours are wasted digging for documentation from meeting notes, emails, Word docs, and PowerPoint slides. With an OKR management platform, all the relevant information is ready when you are. At AOL, CEO Tim Armstrong felt the company's goals were too disconnected, says Bill Pence. They weren't linked together, they didn't cascade up and down, they just didn't stay tethered to the employees and the work they were doing through the year. In 2016, Armstrong brought in a dedicated platform, and rolled out OKRs. The upshot, Pence says, was radical transparency, real-time connection, and a company that coordinated its operations as a matter of course. Let's talk about OKR shepherds. For an OKR system to function effectively, the team deploying it, whether a group of top executives or an entire organization, must adopt it universally. No exceptions, no opt-outs. Yes, there will be late adopters, resistors, and garden variety procrastinators, but to prod them to join the flock, a best practice is to designate one or more OKR shepherds. For years, that role in Google's products department was filled by Senior Vice President Jonathan Rosenberg. Here is one of Jonathan's classic communiques with the laggards' names deleted to protect the guilty. So here's an actual email from Google's OKR shepherd Jonathan Rosenberg, dated August 5, 2010, to his anonymous team. Subject: amidst boundless opportunities, 13 product managers whiff on OKRs. Dear product gang, as most of you know, I strongly believe that having a good set of quarterly OKRs is an important part of being successful at Google. That's why I regularly send you notes reminding you to get them done on time, and why I ask managers to review them to make sure all of our OKRs are good. I've tried notes that are nice and notes that are mean. My personal favorites include threatening you with Jonathan's pit of despair in October of 2007 and celebrating near perfection in July of 2008. Over time, I iterated this carrot-stick approach until we reached nearly 100% compliance. Yay! So then, I stopped sending notes, and look what happened. This quarter, several of you did not get your OKRs done on time, and several others didn't grade your Q2 OKRs. It turns out, it's not the type of note I send that matters, but the fact that I send anything at all. The names of the laggards, the fallen, are duly noted below, with a pass given to several AdMob employees who are new to the ways of Google, and to many of you who missed the deadline, but still got them done in July. We have so many great opportunities before us in search, ads, display, YouTube, Android, enterprise, local, commerce, Chrome and TV, mobile and social, that if you can't come up with OKRs that get you excited about coming to work every day, then something must be wrong. In fact, if that's really the case, come see me. In the meantime, please do your OKRs on time, grade your previous quarter's OKRs, do a good job at it, and post them so that the OKR link from your MoMA intranet page works. This is not administrative busy work. It's an important way to set your priorities for the quarter and to ensure that we're all working together. Signed, Jonathan. Let's talk about midlife tracking. As the Fitbit craze attests, people crave to know how they're progressing and to see it visually represented down to the percentage point. Research suggests that making measured headway can be more incentivizing than public recognition, monetary inducements, or even achieving the goal itself. Daniel Pink, the author of Drive, agrees. The greatest single motivator is making progress in one's work. The days that people make progress are the days they feel most motivated and engaged. Most goal management platforms use visual aids to show progress towards objectives and key results. Unlike steps on Fitbit, OKRs don't require daily tracking, but regular check-ins, preferably weekly, are essential to prevent slippage. As Peter Drucker observed, quote, "Without an action plan, the executive becomes a prisoner of events. And without check-ins to re-examine the plan as events unfold, the executive has no way of knowing which events really matter and which are only noise." As noted in Chapter 4, the simple act of writing down a goal increases your chances of reaching it. Your odds are better still if you monitor progress while sharing that goal with colleagues, two integral OKR features. In one California study, people who recorded their goals and sent weekly progress reports to a friend attained 43% more of their objectives than those who merely thought about goals without sharing them. OKRs are adaptable by nature. They're meant to be guardrails, not chains or blinders. As we track and audit our OKRs, we have four options at any point in the cycle. One, to continue. If it's in the green zone or on track and the goal isn't broken, let's not fix it. 2. Update. We can modify a yellow zone, that means needs attention, key result or objective, to respond to changes in the workflow or external environment. What could be done differently to get the goal back on track? Does it need a revised time limit? Should we backburner other initiatives to free up resources for this one? 3. Start. We can launch a new OKR mid-cycle whenever the need arises. And 4, stop. When a red zone or at-risk goal has outlived its usefulness, the best solution may be to drop it. The point of a real-time dashboard is to quantify progress against a target and flag what needs attention. Although OKRs are primarily a positive force for more, they will also stop us from persisting in the wrong direction. As Stephen Covey noted, quote, "If the ladder is not leaning against the right wall, every step we take just gets us to the wrong place faster." Late in-game surprises are less likely when you track your OKRs for continuous feedback. Good news or bad, reality intrudes. In the process, people can learn from failure and move on, perhaps turning some aspect of the setback into the seedling of a new success. When Remind's school messaging platform prototyped the company's first revenue-yielding service, a peer-to-peer payment system, it was a total flop. Brett Koff says, quote, "No one used it. It didn't solve a clear problem. So we immediately altered the goal to build an event-driven system where the teacher could say, 'I've got a field trip next week. Are you coming? Yes or no? And do you want to pay?'" That changed everything. It started driving and growing like crazy. Whenever a key result or objective becomes obsolete or impractical, feel free to end it midstream. There's no need to hold stubbornly on to an outdated projection. Strike it from your list and move on. Our goals are servants to our purpose, not the other way around. But there's one proviso. When an objective gets dropped before the end of the OKR interval, it's important to notify everybody depending on it. And then comes the reflection. What did I learn that I didn't foresee at the beginning of the quarter? And how will I apply this lesson in the future? For best results, OKRs are scrutinized several times per quarter by contributors and their managers. Progress is reported, obstacles identified, key results refined. On top of these one-on-ones, teams and departments hold regular meetings to evaluate progress towards shared objectives. Whenever a committed OKR is failing, a rescue plan is devised. At Google, the frequency of team check-ins varies with the business needs of the moment, the gap between predicted outcomes and execution, the quality of intra-group communication, and the group's size and locations. The more dispersed the team members, the more frequently they touch base. Google's benchmark check-in cycle is monthly, at a minimum, though goal discussions there are so pervasive that formal meetings sometimes go by the boards. For wrap-up, let's rinse and repeat. OKRs do not expire with the completion of the work. As in any data-driven system, really tremendous value can be gained from post-hoc evaluation and analysis. In both one-on-ones and team meetings, these wrap-ups consist of three parts: objective scoring, subjective self-assessment, and reflection. Let's talk about scoring. In scoring our OKRs, we mark what we've achieved and address how we might do it differently next time. A low score forces reassessment. Is the objective still worth pursuing? If so, what can we change to achieve it? On state-of-the-art goal management platforms, OKR scores are system-generated. The numbers are objective, untouched by human hands. With less automated, homegrown platforms, users may need to perform their own calculations. The simplest, cleanest way to score an objective is by averaging percentage completion rates of its associated results. Google uses a scale of 0 to 1.0, where 0.7 to 1.0 is green, meaning we delivered. 0.4 to 0.6 is yellow, we made progress but fell short. And 0 to 0.3 is red, we failed to make real progress. Google's floor of 0.7 for successful attainment reflects the high ambition of their stretch goals, which you'll hear about in chapter 12. This threshold does not apply to the company's committed operational goals. For sales targets or product releases, any score under 1.0 would be deemed a fail. Intel followed a similar formula. You may recall the OKR for Operation Crush, the company's push to reclaim the microprocessor market. Here are Andy Grove's actual marching orders from the second quarter of 1980, as endorsed and graded by his executive team. Corporate objective was to establish the 8086 as the highest performance 32-bit microprocessor family, as measured by four key results. First, develop and show five benchmarks with superior 8086 family performance. Second, repackage the entire family of products. Third, get the 8 megahertz part into production. And number four, sample the arithmetic coprocessor no later than June the 15th. Here's how these key results were scored. We completed 3 out of 5 benchmarks. That's a grade of 0.6, borderline green. We did indeed repackage the 8086 family under a new product line called IAPX, so that's a perfect 1.0. But production of the 8 megahertz part, which was set for early May, was a fiasco because of problems with the polysilicon. The target had to be pushed to October. That's a 0. As for the arithmetic coprocessor, the goal was to ship 500 parts by June the 15th. We wound up shipping 470, which computes to 0.9, another green. Altogether, we averaged 62.5%, or a raw score of 0.625, on our key results for this objective. That's a respectable grade. The Intel board judged it below expectations, but not too far below, because they knew how aggressive management was in setting our goals. As a rule, we'd enter a quarter knowing we wouldn't achieve all of them. If a department so much as approached 100%, it was presumed to be setting its sights too low, and there would be hell to pay. Let's talk self-assessment. In evaluating OKR performance, objective data should be enhanced by the goal setter's thoughtful, subjective judgment. For any given goal in a given quarter, there may be extenuating circumstances. A weak showing by the numbers might hide a strong effort. A strong one could be artificially inflated. Let's say the team's objective is to recruit new customers, and your individual key result is 50 phone calls. You wind up calling 35 prospects for a raw goal score of 70%. Now, did you succeed or fail? By itself, the data doesn't afford us much insight. But if a dozen of your calls lasted several hours apiece and resulted in 8 new customers, you might give yourself a perfect 1. Conversely, if you procrastinated, rushed through all 50 calls and signed only 1 new customer, you might assess your performance at 0.25 because you could have pushed harder. And on reflection, should the key result have prioritized new customers rather than calls? Or let's say you're a public relations manager and your team's key result is to place 3 national articles about your company. Though you get only 2 pieces published, one is a cover story in the Wall Street Journal. Your raw score is 67%, but you say, I'm giving us a 9 out of 10 because we hit that one out of the park. Googlers are encouraged to use their OKRs in self-assessments as guides, not as grades. As Shona Brown, former SVP of Business Operations, explained to me, it wasn't that they got a red or a yellow or a green, but here was a list of what they delivered on that was above business as usual and connected to the overall goals of the company. The point of objectives and key results, after all, is to get everyone working on the right things. Invariably, some people will grade themselves too harshly, and others may need to be challenged. In either case, an alert facilitator or team leader will jump in and help recalibrate. In the end, the numbers are probably less important than contextual feedback and a broader discussion with the team. Where OKR scores pinpoint what went right or wrong in the work, and how the team might improve, self-assessments drive a superior goal-setting process for the next quarter. There are no judgments, only learnings. Let's talk about reflection. OKRs are inherently action-oriented, but when action is relentless and unceasing, it can be a hamster wheel of grim striving. In my view, the key to satisfaction is to set aggressive goals, achieve most of them, pause to reflect on those achievements, and then repeat the cycle. Learning from direct experience, a Harvard Business School study found, can be more effective if coupled with reflection. That is, the intentional attempt to synthesize, abstract, and articulate the key lessons taught by experience. Philosopher and educator John Dewey went a step further. Quote, "We do not learn from experience. We learn from reflecting on experience." So here are some reflections for closing out an OKR cycle. Did I accomplish all of my objectives? And if so, what contributed to my success? And if not, what obstacles did I encounter? If I were to rewrite a goal achieved in full, what would I change? And importantly, what have I learned that might alter my approach to the next cycle's OKRs? OKR wrap-ups are retrospective and forward-looking at the same time. An unfinished objective might be rolled over to the next quarter with a fresh set of key results, or perhaps its moment has passed and it is appropriately dropped. Either way, sound management judgment comes first. And one more thing, after thoroughly appraising your work and owning up to any shortfalls, take a breath to savor your progress. Throw a party with the team to celebrate your growing OKR superpowers. You've earned it. Chapter 11, Track, The Gates Foundation Story, with Bill Gates, co-chairman of the foundation, and Patty Stonecipher, former CEO. The higher the stakes, the more important it is to track progress, to flag looming problems, to double back from dead ends, and modify goals on the run. In 2000, the newly hatched Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation became something the world had never seen, a $20 billion startup. Though Bill Gates had recently stepped down as CEO of Microsoft, he was still the company's chairman and chief product strategist. He had to find a way to channel the foundation's vast ambition, adapt to fluid conditions in the field, and allow himself, an extremely busy, famously fast-moving founder, to make the best possible choices. To top it off, the newborn institution had signed on for the most audacious mission imaginable. Quote, "Everyone deserves a healthy and productive life." So they enlisted scores of brilliant people who devoted their lives to global health and told them, quick thinking about incremental progress. What would you do if you had unlimited resources? By 2002, the foundation had scaled to the point where it urgently required a more structured form of goal setting. After CEO Patty Stonecipher heard my OKR pitch at an Amazon board meeting, she asked me to present it to the foundation. The rest is OKR history. Here's Patty Stonecipher, and then Bill Gates.
We had the beautiful gift of a blank sheet of paper. How do you want to change the world? But the gift also had a huge weight to it, because when you have that big of a goal, how can you know you're making progress? We felt driven to be responsible with the capital. Bill and Melinda wanted to know that a disciplined system was in place to direct our hard choices. We borrowed from Jim Collins, "What can you be the best at in the world?" Once we figured that out, we laid the OKR system on top of it. We believe that everyone should have a healthy and productive life, and Bill and Melinda were passionate about the role of technology in creating change. That was in our DNA. For a time, we used a global health metric called Disability-Adjusted Life Years, or DALYs. It gave us a data-driven framework for key results, say, to measure the impact of an investment in micronutrients against one to fight river blindness. DALYs led us to focus on vaccines, which makes such an enormous difference in productive life years. Now we had a credible metric, reinforced by our key results. OKRs made it all so clear.
Bill Gates. Ambitious, directional goals were always super important at Microsoft. It was natural in a way, because from a very young age, I thought software was magic. In those early days, the exponential increase in transistors actually mapped to the performance of the device. We understood what the chips people were going to give us, and that there was no end in sight, and that the storage and communication people likewise were writing exponential code. The screen people weren't quite as exponential, but the graphical user interface would be fast enough. There was only one missing element, the magic software to make the device do something interesting. I gave up on being a lawyer or a scientist, surefire things, because the idea of what would happen with all that intelligence, what I called information at your fingertips, was just so fascinating. It was mind-blowing to me. Even before Paul Allen and I started the partnership, we were saying, a computer on every desk and in every home. IBM and other people with resources and skill sets way beyond ours weren't aiming for that goal. They didn't see it as a possibility, so they weren't pushing as hard to make it a reality. But we could see that it would happen. Moore's Law would make things cheaper and get the software industry to critical mass. Those were big, big goals, and they started early for us. That was our biggest advantage. We aimed higher. Making goals concrete. In the year 2000, Melinda and I put $20 billion into the Gates Foundation. Suddenly, it's both a startup and the biggest foundation in the world. And the way the payout rules work, it has to spend a minimum of $1 billion a year. I'd watched Andy Grove manage people on sub-goals, key results. And I watched the Japanese, and I learned how you deal with things when people fall short. I don't think I invented anything there, but I did watch and learn. Then, Patty Stonecipher brought in OKRs, the green, yellow, red approach. And it worked. When we use OKRs with our grand reviews, I felt good about what we were going after. I was still running Microsoft, and my time was limited, and Patty had to make things very efficient between us to make sure we agreed. The goals process was a big part of that. There were two cases where I turned down a grant in the end because the goals weren't clear enough. The OKR system made me confident I was making the right call. I'm a huge fan of goals, but they need to be handled correctly. At one point, the malaria team thought we'd eradicate the disease by 2015, which wasn't realistic. When a goal is too aspirational, it's bad for credibility. In philanthropy, I see people confusing objectives with missions all the time. A mission is directional. An objective has a set of concrete steps that you're intentionally engaged in and actually trying to go for. It's fine to have an ambitious objective, but how do you scale it? How do you measure it? I think it's getting better, though. Philanthropy is bringing in more people from high-performance business environments, and they're tilting the culture. Having a good mission is not enough. You need a concrete objective, and you need to know how you're going to get there.
OKRs allowed us to be ambitious and disciplined at the same time. When measurable key results revealed a lack of progress or showed that an objective was unachievable, we just reallocated the capital. If the goal was to eliminate guinea worm disease, a very ambitious top-line goal, it was important to know whether the dollars and resources were making progress against it. With OKRs, we could set both quarterly and annual beats for substantial key results against such a huge objective. So the foundation made a series of eight-figure grant awards to the Carter Center, and the number of reported cases of guinea worm disease dropped from over 75,000 in 2000 to 4,600-plus in 2008 to just 22 in 2015. Guinea worm disease is now expected to become the second disease in human history to be eradicated after smallpox. Until you set a really big goal, like vaccinating every child everywhere, you can't find out which lever or mix of levers is most important. Our annual strategy reviews began with, what is the objective here? Is it eradication or is it expanding the reach of vaccines? Then we could get more practical with our key results, like the 80-90 rule at the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, where 80% of districts would need to have 90% or more coverage. You need those key results to align your everyday activities, and over time, you keep moving them to be even more ambitious against that really big goal. Sometimes, to be honest, we were probably measuring the wrong thing, but the effort was always there to hold ourselves accountable. At private foundations, where you lack a market effect to gauge impact, you have to pay close attention to whether your data is getting you to the ultimate goal. We were learning so fast that sometimes we had to change data sets midstream. Say you had a seed that would double the production of yams, and you were focused on that number. But then it turned out that nobody would use the seed because the yams took 4 times longer to cook at night. Setting the big goals wasn't as hard as breaking them down. What rocks needed to be moved to achieve them? That's one of the beauties of working with Bill and Melinda. They want to see progress, but bold goals don't faze them.
Case in point, the ongoing fight against the most lethal animal on the planet, the mosquito. In 2016, the Gates Foundation teamed with the British government in a 5-year, $4.3 billion campaign to eradicate malaria, the deadliest of all tropical diseases. Driven by empirical data, they have broadened their focus from a transmission-blocking vaccine to a comprehensive eradication strategy. Objective: global eradication of malaria by 2040. Key results: 1. Prove to the world that a radical cure-based approach can lead to regional elimination. 2. Prepare for scale-up by creating the necessary tools. SIRCAP, single exposure radical cure and prophylaxis, diagnostic. 3. Sustain current goal progress to ensure the environment is conducive to eradication push. The top line objective is to eliminate the Plasmodium parasite from the human population with a special emphasis on drug-resistant strains. As Bill Gates himself has acknowledged, this effort won't be easy. But it has a real chance to succeed because his team is tracking what matters.
Chapter 12 is about superpower number 4, stretch for amazing. Melody Hobson says, "The biggest risk of all is not taking one." OKRs push us far beyond our comfort zones. They lead us to achievements on the border between abilities and dreams. They unearth fresh capacity, hatch more creative solutions, revolutionize business models. For companies seeking to live long and prosper, stretching to new heights is compulsory. As Bill Campbell liked to say, if companies don't continue to innovate, they're going to die. And I didn't say iterate, I said innovate. Conservative goal setting stymies innovation. And innovation is like oxygen. You cannot win without it. You know, when stretch goals are chosen wisely, the payoff merits the risk and then some. Big, hairy, audacious goals. That's Jim Collins' memorable phrase in Good to Great. Spark leaps to new levels. He writes, "A BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal, is a huge and daunting goal, like a big mountain to climb. It is clear, compelling, and people get it right away. A BHAG serves as a unifying focal point of effort, galvanizing people and creating team spirit as people strive towards a finish line. Like the 1960s NASA moon mission, a BHAG captures the imagination and grabs people in the gut." Edwin Locke, the patriarch of structured goal setting, mined a dozen studies for a quantitative correlation between goal difficulty and achievement. The arenas ranged widely, but the results were unequivocal. Locke wrote, "The harder the goal, the higher the level of performance. Although subjects with very hard goals reached their goals far less often than subjects with very easy goals, the former consistently performed at a higher level than the latter. The studies found that stretched workers were not only more productive, but more motivated and engaged. Setting specific challenging goals is also a means of enhancing task interest and of helping people to discover the pleasurable aspects of an activity. In 2007, the National Academy of Engineering asked a panel of leading thinkers, including Larry Page, futurist Ray Kurzweil, and geneticist J. Craig Venter, to choose 14 grand engineering challenges for the 21st century. After a year of debate, the panel settled on an array of quintessential stretch goals. Generate energy from fusion, reverse engineer the brain, prevent nuclear terror, secure cyberspace. You get the picture. Not all stretch goals are so rarefied. Sometimes they represent ordinary work at an extraordinary level. But regardless of scope or scale, they fit my favorite definition of entrepreneurs, which is, entrepreneurs are those who do more than anyone thinks possible with less than anyone thinks possible. By contrast, some people say that bureaucrats do less than anyone thinks possible with more than anyone thinks possible. But regardless, at fledgling startups and market leaders alike, stretch goals can sharpen an entrepreneurial culture. By pushing people past old limits, they are forces for operating excellence. As Philip Potloff, chief digital officer at Edmunds.com, noted, quote, "We're trying to change the way automotive retailing is conducted, and that's a massive challenge and a massive opportunity. The only way for us to boil down our crazy big change the industry goals is through OKRs. That's why OKRs continue to be at the center of what we do." Aspirational stretch goals draw on every OKR superpower. Focus and commitment are a must for targeting goals that make a real difference. Only a transparent, collaborative, aligned, and connected organization can achieve so far beyond the norm. And without quantifiable tracking, how can you know when you've reached that amazing stretch objective? As a sidebar, let's describe two kinds of OKRs. Two baskets. Google divides its goals into two categories, the committed and the aspirational, or stretch goals. And it's a distinction with a real difference. Committed objectives are tied to Google's metrics, product releases, bookings, hiring, customers. Management sets them at the company level, employees at the departmental level. In general, these committed objectives, such as sales and revenue goals, are to be achieved in full, 100% within a set time frame. Aspirational objectives reflect bigger picture, higher risk, more future-tilting ideas. They originate from any tier and aim to mobilize the entire organization. By definition, they are challenging to achieve. Failures, at an average rate of 40%, are part of Google's territory. The relative weighting of these two baskets is a cultural question. It will vary from one organization to the next and from quarter to quarter. Leaders must ask themselves, what type of company do we need to be in the coming year? Agile and daring to crack a new market? Or more conservative and operational to firm up our existing position? Are we in survival mode, or is there cash on hand to bet big for a big reward? What does our business require right now? Let's talk about our need to stretch. Andy Grove was a fan of Abraham Maslow, the mid-20th century psychologist best known for his hierarchy of needs. According to Maslow, only after we satisfy more basic concerns, starting with food and shelter, then safety, then love and belongingness, can we move to higher level motivations. And at the top of Maslow's pyramid, you may recall, is the need for self-actualization. Grove was fascinated to find that some people with no prompting were consistently driven to try to test the outer limits of their abilities and achieve their personal best. These employees were a manager's dream. They were never self-satisfied. But Grove also understood that not everyone was a natural-born achiever. For the rest, stretched goals could elicit maximum output. Such goal setting is extremely important if you want peak performance from yourself and your subordinates. Intel treasured calculating risk takers. It was the place I learned to stretch and to dare to fail. In Operation Crush, the do-or-die campaign to dominate the 16-bit chip microprocessor market, The company's salespeople were measured by design wins, the number of products designed around our 8086 microprocessor. Led by Bill Davidow, the Crush Task Force set one of the bolder goals I've ever seen. 1,000 design wins in a single year, 50% more than sales had logged the year before. Here's what happened next, as recalled by Dave House, general manager for microprocessors. Quote, "This is Intel. You've got to measure it." And I think it was Jim Lally who said, "We need 1,000 design wins." It was a number, and it was either Bill or Jim. And it seemed like an enormous number. And then, as we were developing our plans, somehow the number got changed to 2,000. And that wound up being the number we would take to field sales. 2,000 design wins equated to one win per salesperson per month. Management was asking our field reps to triple their numbers for a chip so unpopular that longtime customers were hanging up on them. The sales force was beaten down and defeated, and now it stared up at Mount Everest. When I recently asked Bill Davidow about setting such a steep objective, he replied, "I picked the 2,000 because I thought we needed a rallying point." And that was a rallying point. The company incentivized the reps with a trip for two to Tahiti for all who reached the mark. Then Jim Lally added an ingenious stipulation. If a single individual failed to make the quota, the straggler's entire district office would lose out on the trip. Early on, the numbers badly trailed the target, and the task force began to think about relaxing the design win criterion. But that summer, full-color Tahiti brochures mysteriously found their way into every salesperson's home mailbox. By the third quarter, peer pressure on the laggards was enormous. At year's end, the design win tally exceeded 2,300. The 8086 reigned supreme in the marketplace. Intel's future was assured. Virtually the entire sales force went to Tahiti, and a stretch goal made all the difference. So let me introduce you to the gospel of 10X. If Andy Grove is the patron saint of aspirational OKRs, Larry Page is their latter-day high priest. In technology, Google stands for boundless innovation and relentless growth. The world of objectives and key results, the company is synonymous with exponentially aggressive goals, or what author Stephen Levy calls the gospel of 10X. Consider Gmail. The main problem with other earlier web-based email systems was meager storage, typically 2 to 4 megabytes. Users were forced to delete old emails to make room for new ones. Archives were a pipe dream. During Gmail's development, Google's leaders considered offering 100 megabytes of storage, an enormous upgrade. But by 2004, when the product was released to the public, the 100 megabyte goal was dead and forgotten. Instead, Gmail provided a full gigabyte of storage, up to 500 times more than the competition. Users could keep emails in perpetuity. Digital communication changed forever. That, my friends, is a big, hairy, audacious goal. Gmail didn't merely improve on existing systems. It reinvented the category and forced competitors to raise their game by orders of magnitude. Now, such 10X thinking is rare in any sector, on any stage. Most people, Larry Page observes, tend to assume that things are impossible, rather than starting from real-world physics and figuring out what's actually possible. In Wired, Stephen Levy elaborated, "The way Page sees it, a 10% improvement means that you're doing the same things as everybody else. You probably won't fail spectacularly, but you are guaranteed not to succeed wildly." That's why Page expects Googlers to create products and services that are 10 times better than the competition. That means he isn't satisfied with discovering a couple of hidden efficiencies or tweaking code to achieve modest gains. 1,000% improvement requires rethinking problems, exploring what's technically possible, and having fun in the process. At Google, in line with Andy Grove's old standard, aspirational OKRs are set at 60 to 70% attainment. In other words, performance is expected to fall short at least 30% of the time. And that's considered success. Google has had its share of colossal misfires, from helpouts to Google Answers. Living in the 70% zone entails a liberal sprinkling of moonshots and a willingness to court failure. At the start of the period, not a single goal may look possible. And so the Googlers are pushed to ask